greetings and welcome to Pod With You.
And also with you.
I'm your host, Suzanne Santo, also known as Suzanne Pizzolatto. Alongside me, handsome stud.
Nick Pizzolatto.
The one and only. Nick, how you doing today?
I'm really good.
Yep.
I just sent off an important piece of work, so I feel productive and like a man who has a reason to exist.
Well, good on you, as it's also International Men's Day, is it not?
It's about time.
Way to just kind of double down on the masculinity. Taking care of business, daddy.
Thank you.
We've had quite a week in the Pizzolatto household. We had a real asshole of a stomach bug run through every single one of us. And it started with our toddler, which I would like to say was a one of the best nights of my life, because
also one of the most harrowing.
It was harrowing. But, you know, if any of you have children, young ones at that, you know, their first puke fest really involves them puking on you because they're scared. They don't know where to put it. And it's going to usually end up on you. But our sweet little girl, you know, in her discomfort, was sick every 30 minutes throughout the night. And when you sit up with your child and care for them and love them, it fulfills a purpose in your biology that is almost difficult to describe. But, you know, neither here nor there. We got through it. We got through it together.
And we did it together.
Made me love you even more.
I got up with her at first, and that was when we just thought she was up and needed to be put back down. And then in the pitch darkness, she started coughing and sat up. And I said, "What's wrong, honey?" And she vomited all over me. And then I tried to carry her to the bathroom, and she kept trying to embrace me while vomiting. And you ran down to bat support. And so we just both ended up staying up all night with her. And then eventually each getting sick ourselves.
Yeah, I got sick.
The irony is that we'd had such a good day.
We had a great day.
Right. And then, yeah, that. So that's really slowed us down the last week. And it feels good to be getting back on track.
To pod with you again. Yes.
And also with you.
So this week's episode, we're going to talk about beginnings. We're going to talk about our respective creative beginnings. And if we have time, possibly the beginning of our love affair that you are
listening in on. Okay.
I'll try not to be too raunchy.
Hit it. I don't think people would mind that from you, but maybe they would.
Married couples talking about their raunchiness.
Oh.
Well, who's doing it? Is anyone doing it?
I don't know. It seems like most of the married people talk about their raunchiness with other people. It's weird.
Unacceptable.
Yeah.
So Nicholas, let's start with you. You want to start?
Sure.
Okay. So you grew up in Lake Charles, Louisiana.
Yes, I did.
You know, it's not art wasn't necessarily your first instinct growing up, right?
Well, I mean, it was my instinct. If what you mean is, you know, maybe my immediate culture or family didn't.
The environment wasn't cultivating the writer we see today, at least.
Well, not obviously, right?
Obviously,
but it was giving me material
sure.
the whole time. Like, you know, your life is your material.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave me some dramatic material that way.
Yeah.
But I started out as a visual artist because I grew up kind of an isolate and spent most of my time alone in a room drawing pictures. And
people don't know that about you. You're a very talented artist.
Well, thanks.
Painter.
I mean, I used to be. I don't know how that would shake out now, but I spent.
Draw me like one of your French girls.
How do you know about that?
What? Oh, no. Oh, God. Now I have to go kill people. Hold on. Be right back.
Yeah. So I mean, when I think about my childhood and a lot of my adolescence, it was a lot of it is this boy alone in a room drawing. But that ended up allowing me to go to college because I had a visual arts scholarship to Louisiana State University. And while there and a visual arts major, I became disenchanted with that world. I started to see all the manufactured value.
Yeah, there's some weird shit.
Yeah, in the art world. And I was a really good draftsman. Mm-hmm. I could draw pretty close to photorealistically if I wanted, or expressionistically, mm-hmm. In a variety of mediums. But I saw that me doing that and somebody blowing their nose on a piece of canvas were seen to have equal value if the proper intellectual rationalization
decided it so,
could be delivered. Right. So there was that. And also, it was a very expensive major. The mm-hmm. supplies were very expensive. And I was always really poor, working two jobs and stuff. And I had gravitated in my studies to literature and philosophy because I found those things answered something in me that was yearning to find its expression, to find some modality by which it could begin a discourse. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I'm saying there is, since I was a kid, I understood the power of words and the power of stories. I saw the people around me, the adults, and that everyone ran on stories. And another thing I saw as a kid from the people around me was that feeling, thinking, and action did not quite add up to a coherent narrative, and certainly not one where meaning was easily legible. Mm. By that I mean, I would witness the people around me didn't seem to have much control over the most elemental facets of their life. Well, they frequently did things they wish they hadn't.
Right.
They did things that they were ashamed of doing.
Sure.
They lost control mm-hmm. in ways you couldn't predict.
Right.
And so searching for meaning and searching for some kind of rules that would let me know, if you do this, you'll be okay. If you do that, you'll be okay. Mm-hmm. Don't do this. That was not easy.
Right.
And I think I was always going to be an artist of some kind, but the visual language in and of itself didn't satisfy me, because what I needed art to do was to act in some way as a sense-making machine for the world around me and for my experience of the human condition. And all my best stuff, or the moment when one of my works sort of transcends what it was supposed to be and becomes something a bit bigger or a bit better, those tend to be the moments where I'm in a flow state where my unconscious is freely having a dialogue between two completely conflicting points of view, and they both make sense. And some kind of truth arises out of that that I couldn't have apprehended and I couldn't have preconceived. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have said, well, I'm gonna resolve this paradox, and because I don't know it's happening until it's happening, and it only happens by me inhabiting characters. So when I discovered real literature in college, I think it started to answer that desire in me for art to not just express what I felt and what I saw, but for it to make sense of it. Mm. For that, I would need a narrative. I would need to be able to recreate human personality. Mm-hmm. Now, being a writer was something I had no idea how one did. I always loved stories and storytelling, and I knew I had some sort of verbal facility. Even when I was a kid, nobody liked me, but people listened when I talked. And I was aware of that.
That's true. Nobody liked you.
You'll have to take my word for it.
I know
it's hard to imagine, but it's true. I just wasn't socialized. And writing, though, it was almost shamanic or something. Like if you take up music or you take up even the visual arts, there are chords to follow. There are notes to learn. There are principles that you can attach to, and if you learn them, you'll at least learn your craft. Even if you don't transcend craft to become a quote-unquote artist, you'll still, for instance, be able to play the guitar if you learn to play the guitar. Mm-hmm. Sort of the same thing with painting. You can learn techniques.
Sure.
But with writing, it was sort of like, well, where do you go to learn this, and how does one even learn this? Mm-hmm. It It's both incredibly simple and infinitely complex. It's 26 letters of the alphabet. Mm-hmm. It's sentences.
Right.
But within that tiny, simple form, you can recreate the complexity of existence. And in that way, it always seemed magical to me, and it still seems magical to me. Mm-hmm. So fast forwarding, I was majoring in English and philosophy, and I was going to go to law school because I was really sick of being poor. And I thought, you know, according to these tests or whatnot, I'm supposed to be a smart guy. So I should be able to figure out a way to make some money that doesn't kill me and doesn't see me totally betraying myself, right?
Do you know what kind of law you were going to go into?
I don't know, but I'm sure it would have been some form of trial law.
And God help whoever is on the other end of your case.
I think
the opposing counsel.
You know, to bring it back to storytelling, I think that would have been my strength as a
lawyer.
Is being in court.
Oh my God.
Is being in court and putting a jury on my narrative.
All the jurors are going to side with you, and they're going to leave there being like, why do I want to sleep with that guy?
Thanks, honey.
He's so handsome, and his words are mellifluous and beautiful.
You're so good to me. I took my LSATs and everything, and I had a year of college left, and I just had all electives remaining. So I took this independent study course called novel writing, and it just sounded interesting to me. Like, oh, well, I'll see what it's like to write a novel. And the professor told me if I just turned in 30 pages three times during the semester, and it seemed like I was trying, he would give me an A. He didn't expect anybody to take the class and, you know, write a good novel. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay. And I just started writing this unfiltered kind of autobiographical thing. And I turned it into him, and he was very supportive and encouraged me to take the year off after I finished college and hold off on law school and finish this book. And he was going to help me in whatever way he could and get it to his agent. And I thought that was great. So that's what I planned to do. And after college, I moved to Austin and I bartended. And
at the Hula Hut.
Shout out to the Hula Hut.
And other places, right?
Yeah. But I didn't do much writing because my former teacher died 2 months after I graduated. And it was a real tragedy. He was a young man loved by many people. His name was Matt Clark. And I, you know, that was sort of my only connection to the writing world. And then I just lived and worked in Austin for about 3.5 years until I was about 24 and was feeling pretty tired of watching the sun come up. And decided, okay, I'm getting too old for this. I need to either give writing a real shot or just go to law school. And so I opted to give writing a shot for a few years. And I wrote some samples and applied to master's programs and ended up going to Arkansas. And I just figured, you know, I'll do this for a few years. It's not costing me any money. And if nothing happens, I'll go to law school like I always planned to. But the first two stories I wrote for a workshop were bought by the Atlantic Monthly. And so that kind of
set me... Which is like a really big deal.
Yeah, I mean, at the time it was a really big deal because they paid real money for stories. They published one a month. They got several hundred, at least, submissions a month, thousands a year. And for them to just buy two stories from me was, it was kind of unprecedented. And it was about as auspicious a debut as you could hope for somebody in my position.
You're like, oh, I guess I'm good.
Yeah, or maybe I think I can do this. And also, it was
they like me.
It was at a time still when New York publishing houses paid big money for a first collection of stories and a proposed novel from new writers who had been published in the big glossy magazines. Mm-hmm. And I kept writing short stories because that was just kind of the thing you did in these kinds of fields of study, master's programs. I don't want to make them sound too fancy. And
I could hear you pushing your glasses up your nose.
I don't
He's
wear
not glasses.
Wearing glasses. And I published a bunch of other stories in journals and a couple magazines, but the only place that bought the collection of stories was a small publishing house in San Francisco. So I didn't make any money off it. But I could get jobs at good universities because of my publication records. So I did that. I never intended to be a teacher, but it was kind of the only thing I was qualified for when I finished my degree. Did that for a few years, and I spent 2 years writing a novel that I pulled from publication when it was in galleys because it wasn't very good. And then
galleys.
Galleys are the final form of the manuscript when it's been set for the printer. So it's basically what it will look like as a book. And this mm-hmm. is your last chance to edit it before it's printed.
Okay.
And that's when I pulled it. And had to give them their money back.
Oh, man.
Yeah, but, you know, it just wasn't very good. And it wasn't up to my standards. And then I felt my back was kind of against the wall. And I said, okay, I just wasted 2 years doing that, even though they weren't wasted.
This explains so much.
Yeah.
This is a thing.
Probably. I mean, if you know me, you're like, of course you did that.
Of course you did. That's what I'm saying. I'm like, this lands. This totally lands.
And so I thought, well, what's a book I would like to read? What's a genre I like to read that I find entertaining? And so I thought about crime novels, and that instead of trying to write Finnegan's Wake and be the teacher's pet, I was going to write a genre novel that I would be proud of. And that ended up being Galveston, and I wrote it really fast. I wrote it inside 2 months, and waking up every day.
Hell of a novel, folks, if you haven't read it.
Waking up every day at 5 a.m., blah, blah, blah. And when it was published, it got a really great review from Dennis Lehane in the New York Times. And it was optioned by a producer in Hollywood. It was only optioned for like $6,000, you know, no real money. But that allowed me to talk to Hollywood agents for the first time. Mm-hmm. To the two women who've remained my agents.
Yep.
At the time, they just had a little boutique agency that mostly specialized in literary rights. But I got to speak to them on the phone, and I said, you know, how do I put myself up for the job of adapting this novel as the screenplay? And while I've got you on the phone, how do I break into TV writing? And while we're talking about TV writing, how do I become a showrunner? I've been reading about showrunning, and I think I'd be really good at it. And they kind of laughed just like that. And they were like, well, have you ever written scripts before? And I said, no. And they said, well, you need to write some scripts. And they said, look, if you write a great spec script of an existing TV show and a great original pilot for a show you make up, and they're really good, we can get you meetings. And then at the meetings,
did you write one for an existing TV show?
Yeah, I did.
What show?
Justified.
Oh, I don't think I knew that.
You might have, but I could tell they weren't taking me seriously. So over the course of 5 weeks, I wrote 6 TV scripts. And
you psycho.
I know. Like I don't even know how I did that, but I bet I'll never be that hungry again, God willing. Because I just,
your next on the menu was Hungry for Love.
I was 34 years old, and I felt like I was trying to make up for lost time.
Yeah.
And so I wrote a spec script for Justified. I wrote 3 original scripts for a show I created set around the casino riverboats in Lake Charles. I wrote another pilot for a show about bull riders. And then the last pilot I wrote was True Detective. and I kept that one next to me. They didn't even use that one to try to get me jobs. They used the original show. And so I flew out to LA because I got a bunch of meetings off of those scripts they submitted. Mm-hmm. And then it was a revelation for me to be in those rooms with the executives, because I was sort of like, oh, this is like a locker room.
In a sea of devils?
No. I don't look at it like that at all. I didn't see those people as devils at all. I saw them as patrons. And it was my job to convince the patrons why I would be a good investment of their resources,
right?
But in some other ways, it was both like a locker room and like a classroom, because like, I'm going to teach you guys why you should invest in me. Mm-hmm. And it's also like a locker room because you've got these egos and stuff.
Right.
And fortunately, I'm really good in locker rooms and classrooms. Basically, every meeting I took, I got offered a job.
Great.
And so a month later, I've moved to LA. I have a job as a staff writer on this brand new show called The Killing, and I have a blind pilot deal with HBO, which was not for True Detective. It was for that bull riding show. And suddenly I'm sort of off to the races. Mm-hmm. And at The Killing, I learn how to make television.
Right.
Because the showrunner, Vina Sood, who was really great this way, the writers would go produce their episode. So, you know, a couple months before I was teaching college, then I'm on a TV set and I'm just learning what everybody does mm-hmm. and how you do this and how mm-hmm. these things get made. And it was a great education. I end up asking out of this during the second season of The Killing when we were still in the writer's room.
Which, by the way, is like being a staff writer on any show, and that was actually a really big show, is like a great accomplishment for a lot of writers. And you just walked away from it.
Yeah, it was one of those things I do periodically in my life mm-hmm. where I suppose I burn a bridge, but then I build two or three more. So the reason I left was for a variety of reasons, but in the main, you know, I'd been in Hollywood for about a year and a half, and I'd already earned four times the amount of money I would have earned if I had taught that year.
Right.
So I was already playing with house money to me. And this was all still kind of fantasy camp to me. Like, yeah, I'm doing Hollywood fantasy camp for right. a while. And when you go to fantasy camp, you don't go to bunt. You go to swing for the fences, right? Right? And I'd been sitting on True Detective. And
why were you sitting on it?
Well, because I was waiting until I could do it. I wasn't going
to
give it.
You didn't want to give it to somebody else?
I wasn't going to give it to somebody else.
Wow.
And Alejandro Iñárritu wanted to do it. And he had asked for a second
Who's
episode.
That?
Oh, one of the greatest living film directors. He did Amores Perros and The Revenant and okay. Birdman.
Right, right, right.
And I wrote a second episode and he loved it. And he wanted to do the series. The thing was, is we were going to have to wait for him to finish The Revenant. And that was going to be, as it turned out, another 2.5 years. So yeah. We decided to just move forward. And honestly, it's good for me that he didn't do it, because I would have gotten shot out of an airlock as soon as the show entered production. And as it was, that didn't happen. So then we got the actors, we packaged it. When I say we, I mean me and Steve Golan, who's now passed, but a legendary Hollywood producer who's done amazing work, shelves full of Oscars and Emmys and Golden Globes. And he started Anonymous Content. And I had taken another meeting with him.
Which is a production company.
Yeah, it's a production and management company. I'd taken a meeting with him in New York about doing the remake of the Jean-Jacques Audiard movie, A Prophet, which had just come out the year before, and Steve had the remake rights to. And when I sat down to lunch with him, he said, okay, Nick, why should I remake this movie? And I said, oh, I didn't know this was that kind of meeting. You should not remake this movie. That's a really bad idea. And I said, it's a perfect movie. It came out last year. Like, what's your best chances? You might make something that's as good as that movie, and then it's just not embarrassing. And he goes, well, why are you taking the meeting then? And I said, well, because I love that movie and I don't want anybody else to screw it up. If you're going to remake it, it should be with me. And I gave, and he goes, well, do you have a take? And I gave him my take. He's like, that's pretty good. He goes, but you don't want to do it. And I said, I don't want you to do it. I said, if you're going to do it, I want to do it. And he goes, well, and then we just talked for a while. He goes, well, what should we do together? And I had my iPad and I pulled up True Detective and I said, we should do this. And so Steve read it and that was where we started. And about a year later, we had the actors and we took it out as a package. And, you know, the rest is history, as yeah. they say. Mm-hmm. But so that's the long story of my beginnings, with a lot of anecdotes left out for sure. But that's how I came to be where I am, I guess.
It's such a beautiful journey, and like the calling was so clear, you know, and I love it. I never get sick of hearing you talk about how it all came to be. And, you know, I think it's good for people to hear stories like this because, I don't know, ambition and drive seem to be waning in society, you know?
Well, I don't know. I see a lot of ambitious people. It's just the things they're ambitious about. For.
That's true.
Yeah.
It's more like,
are you sure that's what you want? Are you sure?
You know, I had this thought the other day. We made this pact to like not scroll for the week on social media. And I was thinking to myself this morning of when I've scrolled and like all the random people that come into your life or into your consciousness and you're watching these people make a video because everyone can do it.
Yeah.
And, it's really feels like Black Mirror at this point, you know, because now you get paid for it. Now you get paid for,
oh, I know.
How many people look at your stupid video with the goat or whatever.
It is what it is. And, you know,
it's not art. Well, some of it's art.
I guess some of it's art, but I guess I suppose it's just a difference in what do you want from art? And for me, what I want, or I guess if I'm going to draw a distinction between craft and art,
mm-hmm.
Which some people wouldn't draw any distinction. But I would say one of the qualities that differentiates the latter from the former is emotional resonance.
Mm-hmm.
If I encounter art, be it music, a painting, a film, a TV show, it should in some way resonate with me emotionally. It should provoke some kind of expansion within me.
Yes.
To feel something genuine and authentic that has been transmitted to me through the power of the artist's work. So, you know, what I tend to want from art and what I tend to want from my own art is that emotional resonance. And also, you know, then the other thing with beginnings is how do you practice this craft? You know, because I know the way I work now is much different than the way I worked 15 years ago. And it's much different than the way I worked 10 years ago.
I think it kind of comes back to that, like knowing your strengths and limitations. And so if you were like giving advice to another burgeoning young writer or something, like don't try to be like anybody else.
No. And it's perfectly fine to start with influences and to begin by imitating your influences. But eventually you should attain a level of craft that pushes you past all influence.
Okay.
And when I think about the process itself, the way I work now is so much different than the way I used to, and it's so much more intuitive. I used to be able to codify and verbalize things much better, particularly when I was a teacher. And now so much of it's been internalized. I work from this interior space that is pushing itself out.
Mm.
But the thing that stayed the same is it remains a vehicle for me to make sense and meaning out of the human experience. And it becomes a way I know myself. When I am doing it correctly, I access my higher self.
Sure.
Whatever it is, if it's my subconscious or if it's some kind of zeitgeist, world spirit, whatever, when I'm in that flow state, I feel like I'm transcribing almost, not like I'm creating. And in that way, it becomes this vehicle where I come to know myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that remains the ongoing project, is nothing makes me think more deeply or clearly about anything than writing about it. And there is no version of me that is more compassionate, more empathetic, and more wise than the guy who's writing about people who don't exist and has infinite compassion for anybody who finds themselves on my page, no matter their characters. You know, we spoke before about watching True Detective season one, mm-hmm. together.
Yeah.
Which is something we did when our daughter was born and we were in this baby tunnel. And I hadn't seen the show since it aired 10 years before. I had never watched it again. And we would watch one episode a night while we just stayed up with the baby. And
she was like, what, 3 weeks old?
Yeah, a couple weeks.
Something like
that. A couple
weeks. Yeah, tiny baby.
And it was so weird because my own father at the time was in hospice care, and he'd been paralyzed from the neck down 5 months earlier. So we had this new life and this old life going away, and I'm wrapped up in it with you. And we're watching True Detective season one, and we get this line from Matthew's character, Cole, where he's speaking about his father, who was very, very hard on him and gave him something of a traumatic upbringing. And Matthew says, when the cop says, were you still mad at him? And he says, I didn't say I was mad at him. And he goes, but said you guys hated each other. He said, I didn't say that. I said, we didn't like each other. There's mm-hmm. a difference. And he says, and you know, looking back at everything that came at me after I left home, I look back at my dad and I see he was just preparing me for what was to come. And in that way, he was a friend to me. And I remember having forgotten that I wrote that and then remembering I wrote it when we saw that scene and thinking about my own father. And that's just an example of, well, if I had
discovering yourself.
Yeah, yeah, if I had not been writing that, I never would have attained the level of consciousness possible mm-hmm. to look at someone who had hurt me mm-hmm. and really made things very painful for me
right.
to look at them and say, oh, he, in his way, he was a friend to me.
Yeah.
And even when you or people remark something about me not being afraid or not acting out of fear, I have to give that to my father. Like, yeah.
I think knowing so much detail, of your life, like it's difficult to say that your father was a friend to you. However, the lessons and the sculpting of your character. Yeah. I mean, you can give a nod of gratitude for that. For
I can
sure.
say, I can say this about him. He didn't break me.
Yeah.
And he made me strong.
Yeah.
So would any of my work exist without him? I seriously doubt it.
Yeah.
I seriously doubt it. And in that way, I don't have anything in me anymore but love for the man.
And did writing help you with that?
Of course it did.
Yeah,
of course it did. It helped me make sense of things. Mm-hmm. It gave me a story I could believe in.
Right.
About the world I came from. And so, you know, my process has gotten more and more mysterious, but the aim has gotten simpler and simpler and simpler. I'm just trying to get to the heart of things.
Well, I think too, like where you're at now with all the projects, you know, you've got on your plate, it's, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's like, you know, when you first started writing and you first wrote True Detective and you had all this fire and ready, like you want me to write a spec script? I'm going to write five, you know, yeah. It's like, that was that chapter. And this chapter is the other side of your wisdom, you know, and all the years of life in between. And, you know, you're not a 20, were you 34?
I was 34 when I got to Hollywood. I was 35 when we sold True Detective.
And, you know, in some ways that like the pace of it is troublesome for you, but also like, I think the space is actually, it's good to talk about that. Like, it's like, oh, I'm not writing songs like I was when I was 24. Cause I used to write every single day and try to practice for 5 hours a day, you know, but it's not like that, you know, your life changes creatively.
And the thing is when I work now, I get to the good stuff a lot faster.
Right. Exactly.
And I can say that like, the stuff I'm writing now is not like the stuff I wrote then, but you can see that it's part of the same coherent voice. Mm-hmm. And I think there has been growth. One of the things writing has done for me is that at every stage of my adult life, it has alchemized my experience and in some way shown me my own identity at those times. Mm-hmm. Like the short stories, those are a young man's short stories. A young man with an old spirit, maybe, but those are a young man's stories. The novel, is a new father's novel.
Galveston?
Yeah. A novel about a man who wants to be something different than he has been.
Mm.
And then True Detective, the all three seasons are me at various stages of my mature adulthood, figuring things out until you have this very absolutist, you know, swaggeringly masculine first season. And then you get the third season, which is much less absolutist about anything and is more concerned with time and memory and what obligations we have to the history of our own life and to what happened. And so in that way, that's another great benefit of art, is that if you take it as far as you can, you will always have something that can grow with you. You will have an engine for growth, and you will have a vehicle that responds to that growth and promotes more of it. And I think that's the final blessing of it that I have to remind myself of when the work's coming slow or I'm tired of being out in the guest house all day making stuff up, is that I'm engaged in something that has meaning, and it's going to reveal its meaning to me. And then it's going to show me what I've done. And in that way, it's going to reveal me to myself.
That's beautiful. Yeah.
Well, thanks.
Well, I mean, it's important. It's like you have this immense respect for it. That's a good way to approach it. You know, it works with you.
Yeah. And when I don't have a respect for it, when I get resentful for it, when I feel like maybe I made a wrong turn somewhere about 20 years earlier, it's always wrong. And then when I come back to the slightest respect, that respect in process turns into reverence at some point. Mm. And I'm glad to be here. And I'm glad I did the work. Because
I think a lot of people are glad you did the work.
Well, thanks, honey. But I don't like the process. And I don't I don't really like the work. But I love having worked. I love having written. I think that's a Flannery O'Connor quote, I think. Do you like to write? No, I don't. I like having written. So I think now we should turn our attention to you and your story, which is
a very different story. And I don't know if it's as interesting, to be honest.
I think it's completely interesting. So to fill in the listeners, you started your career in entertainment first as a teenage model.
Yes.
Right. And then that opened doors to start acting for you. Mm-hmm. And you had a lot of success right out the gate, being cast as guest stars on TV shows and getting a movie role and stuff. And you moved to LA at 19. You moved to LA, and shortly after
let's pump the brakes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Let me tell you.
Let's do it.
Let me tell it.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, it's okay.
I was trying to catch everybody up.
No. Well, you know, there's a lot in between, and I appreciate listening to your, you know, the details from your beginnings, because I forget stuff about my own. And, you know, I grew up in the suburbs of Cleveland, Ohio, Parma, Ohio, and then Strongsville. And in the course of a few years, we moved schools a lot. So I had three different schools in 4 years. And my sisters were a few years older than me. And so I was pretty lonely. And I didn't really have a lot of friends. And I spent a lot of time alone.
Hard to imagine.
There was a few summers where it was just like me and my parents. And I'd work at the restaurant. My family owned an Italian restaurant that's still in my family. My grandparents started it. And it's been in the family for about 60 years now. And I actually feel like it's called Santos. A lot of my just sort of performance elements to them being molded in the restaurant, you know, because you're hosting, you're serving, you are part of this energy that involves creating a pleasant and enjoyable experience for people, which is what I've aimed to do my whole life as a musician, you know?
Right.
But,
and there was also, right, like crooner music playing.
Yeah.
Time,
lots
too.
Of crooner music.
And I fell in love with it.
Yeah. I fell in love with Rosemary Clooney and Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and, you know, Louis Prima. It was just like, I still love that music. It's the songs of nostalgia for me. But, you know, when I was 14, I got really tall and, you know, people would tell me I should look into modeling. And I just asked my mom to take me to a casting call. And, you know, before I knew it, I was like working all the time, just local catalog. It's nothing to write home about, but I was working and making money. And I was so aware that that was, not something to scoff at. Like yeah. I was saving money and I spent my summer when I was 15 in Chicago. And then I was scouted for an agency in Tokyo the following summer when I was 16. And I spent the summer in Tokyo and like looking back now, you know, obviously this was in the 90s. It's a very different world. And I have a very, very special trusting relationship with my mom and dad. I cannot imagine our 16-year-old being like, bye.
No,
never. I can't imagine her a few years from now doing that.
I can confidently say like, nothing that you did prior to age 21 would ever fly with any of my daughters.
Let's be specific. We're talking about career.
Yeah, yeah. I'm talking about like, oh, you want to move to New York? Yeah, okay, bye, honey. You, well, you're the boss.
Yeah, bye.
No.
So yeah, then I moved to New York when I was 16, that following fall. And I actually moved there a week before 9/11, 2001. So I was there for the whole thing and it was pretty insane. You know, just as like my life was like, now I'm in Tokyo, now I'm going yeah. to New York. And I guess I like picked up just this sort of unabashed momentum where I was like, all right, let's do it.
What else can I do?
Yeah. Like there was this time in my life where any job I wanted, I got it. Mm-hmm. And I really garnered this just sense of wonder. It was sort of like my fantasy camp a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I wish that lasted longer than it did because I think I would have gotten a lot farther. But I sort of hit a wall of cynicism after a while. And that actually started when I was acting, because acting is a very unforgiving business. And, you know, rejection is sort of like par for the course. You're just going to get rejected. Even if you were the best actor in the room, you yep. just were too tall or yep. they wanted a blonde or whatever. You know, you just have to kind of, you know, metabolize that. And I'm a really sensitive person. So, you know, I started to lose my affinity for it. And honestly, as an actor, my favorite things I ever did were in acting class, because you really studied philosophy and the human condition in a way that was just so rewarding. And it's almost like writing in that way, you know, you're mm-hmm. investigating characters and emotion. And 100%. I found that to be the most fulfilling area of acting was class.
When I taught writing, I would have my students read the condensed version of the Stanislavski system by Sonia right. Moore.
Yeah.
And we would discuss the Stanislavski method acting mm-hmm. method, because I wanted them to be able to understand human beings.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. No, it's just, it's funny when I look back at like when I really thought I was going to act, like that was the thing, you mm-hmm. know, and I'm really glad that didn't work out.
I don't even think it didn't work out. I think you walked away from it.
I did walk away from it.
So everything's going fine in New York. You moved to LA.
Mm-hmm. Moved to LA at 19. And I really like almost had to start over, you know, uh-huh. all of the sort of front of the line New York stuff I had going
like
on,
casting and stuff.
Producers, yeah. like just went away. And I was, and it was very different in Los Angeles and I didn't like it. I didn't like the difference. It was less about the art and, you know, the craft and the school. It was more about like hot girls and stuff. And I was never the hot girl.
Hard to believe.
I wasn't. Have you seen my boobs?
I've seen pictures.
You've seen pictures of my boobs. Oh, it was hilarious. Well, maybe if you're nice to me, I'll show you the real thing. Hello, my name is Suzanne. I love you.
So you're in LA.
So I'm in LA, and you know, I've always been musical. I could always sing. I always loved singing.
You played the violin.
I played the violin. I started playing when I was 11, and I got pretty good. And when it was time to go to high school, I got a scholarship for my high school. But I never thought anything of this. I never thought about being in bands or performing as a musician at all. But when I got to LA, I was so fucking lonely and really like didn't have friends for like 2 years, just about. Like it took a while to like really find like other Midwesterners, basically, that like my kind of people. And I started singing and writing and taught myself how to play guitar. And
this is like you're doing a lot of open mic nights.
No, not even then yet. I just was playing by myself and really just enjoyed. I just enjoyed it. And as an outlet, as you know, you're talking about, you know, shamanic writing and discovering yourself. Like I felt that that's what was happening. And I loved writing and I loved turning words into songs and melodies and felt so deeply about it. And really did discover myself in that way. And coincidentally, I had a roommate who was a booker for open mics, and her best friend was this engineer producer. And I ended up playing my first open mic, and it was like the people I met in that room, I literally knew the rest of my life, you know? And it was just like illuminating. I loved it so much, and I loved that it was mine and it wasn't like an audition that could just be taken away from you. You know, it's like I had control over the creative power that I felt, you know, and not even power, just like the connection to my spirit.
Well, is it right to say too, like you had total agency over your work, you know?
Yes.
If you're an actor and you're in film and television, you couldn't be in less control of how your work is seen by others.
Sure.
You don't know what's going to happen in the edit.
Yep.
You don't know how your performance is going to get chopped up.
Totally.
But you're a musician, you're playing music. It must be just instantly gratifying. You know, you can feel it while you're playing.
Yeah. There's a like, I mean, this is going to sound weird, but sometimes to this day, when I'm onto something that's good, it's like you get a whole body high, or I get goosebumps. I cry, and it sounds, it's not like you're getting off on yourself. You're just, you tapped into something that is larger than you, and you worked with it, you know, you coalesced with it in a way that,
or you danced with it.
Yeah. And when that happens, like the only thing is to keep going and see it through and make sure you do everything you can to have it fully formed. And you know, that's sort of an obligation because, you know, at the end of the day, even at that point in my life, like I knew I had a gift, and when you have a gift, you want to use it well. Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's really funny. I met my bandmate for the band Honey Honey through this other engineer friend of my roommate. So like my Craigslist roommate, you know, like I find this place on Craigslist, and this one girl, you know, gets me my first gig, my first band, and then like the rest of my life, you know, goes from there. And Honey Honey, we put our first song on MySpace, and within like a week or two, record companies were reaching out, and there was this specific man named Bertrand Lembleu.
What song was that?
From France. This was, I think it was Bouncing Ball. Hmm. I didn't write Bouncing Ball, but it caught a lot of attention. And Bertrand was a French record label executive who came to the States to basically like find us a home. And even though he did get us a record contract, they kicked him out and I never saw him again. Yeah. But it was a really interesting time because I really wasn't accustomed to MySpace or, you know, all the things that came thereafter in social media and streaming. But it was a powerful tool at the time. And like I was meeting up with like the legendary mixer Bob Clearmountain and his family and like people that were just like, oh my God, we heard your song. And like it was wild. And I was pulled in a lot of different directions by very powerful people that wanted me to have a solo career.
Yeah.
And I chose to stay in this duo band, which is a really interesting thing because I know I did the right thing if I wanted to hold on to my integrity, I believe, because pop was the thing that the big companies,
for the money was.
That's what they wanted. And I think it's kind of like, you know, I guess we do have a lot of similarities. Like, you know, you walked away from these big jobs or you decided to pull your book at the last minute because it wasn't good enough. Like, I didn't go with these people because my instinct was that it wasn't right. Like my instinct was like Steve Berman called my cell phone, like a very powerful record label.
Yeah.
And like, I just, I don't know. I didn't go with them.
Okay. And well, so that brings us up to Honey Honey.
Right.
Did Honey Honey feel right? And, you know, maybe talk about that for a second and talk about why ultimately you left Honey Honey.
It's funny. It's like, I don't know if that felt right either. It was like, I felt like I was to be loyal to my bandmate because like we started a band and we're going to see this band through. And, you know,
what does that mean? See it through.
To success, to, you know, completion, I guess, to this thing that we thought we would get. And by the way, like Honey Honey didn't do a bad job. Like they did okay.
No, I'm just saying when you talk about things like that, like that's one of those never ending cycles.
Right.
Now. If like, we're going to see this through, what does that mean? You know, like there is no seeing it through. There's no completion.
Well,
there's no seeing it to completion.
You know, I have a lot of gratitude for Honey Honey. I learned to be, I don't want to say the musician I am today, but I kind of cut my teeth on songwriting in that band. And
yeah.
I wished I left earlier than I did because it was dragged on for too long. And you know, just like more history, like our first record deal was signed with Kiefer Sutherland's label. And that was insane. You know, this was the height of his show 24, which was a massive hit. And so, you know, I was 22, 23 at the time. And I'm like, you know, being escorted around New York City with Kiefer Sutherland, doing interviews for MTV and, you know, this kind of stuff. And it's insane. But like so broke, I couldn't, you know, afford a cab ride home. Right. Like it was just like that.
That seems to be a lot of musicians.
It's some silly shit, you know? And like those, when you're 22 or 23, you don't care about you don't think about your future.
Well, you think things are just going to keep growing.
And so what I learned, you know, within that year and the next is like, when you get a record deal, that doesn't mean anything.
Right.
And nobody's going to work harder than you are. So when you think that, oh, I got a deal, now everything's going to open up, you have to like double down on your work ethic because half these people are alcoholics and they're just here to have a good time. And so, you know, you kind of get chewed up in this machine. And I would say I've been chewed up in the machine, but you know, not so much that I couldn't walk anymore. And so, you know, with Honey Honey, had several record deals. Some I have to actually like remember who we worked with. And then around 2016, I started recording my first solo record, which was a huge deal because I really thought that Honey Honey was all I would ever have. And I didn't really have the confidence to do anything on my own. I'd kind of been mired in a little bit of a, you know, codependency and
kind of dynamic that
right. And when I was able to break out of it and discover my own power, I guess, on my own, it was like, you know, like I said, I have a lot of gratitude for Honey Honey, but it was like I was set free. I mean, I couldn't believe how, like, just not having to worry about another person, just doing it by myself, however I wanted, you know, a live show to be, however much I wanted to talk, however, you know, long I wanted to play. It was just so much better for me and with who I am. And so around 2016, 2017, I really started playing as a solo artist. I released my first record, Ruby Red, produced by Butch Walker, who had a lot to do with giving me the confidence that I have now. Just was like, hey, you're good. You can do this, you know? And I did my first solo, my first, you know, gig out of Honey Honey opening for him. And I mean, I had the best time. I just couldn't believe I could do it. It was, it's sad to think about it. It's sad to think that I really didn't think I could play a show by myself.
Yeah.
You know, and now it's like my preferred brand because your overhead's low. It's just you. So, you know, and now I
running
love,
clean.
Now I, you know, open up for Gary Clark about once a year in front of a few thousand people. And it's just
great.
The best time. But, you know, I also got to do a lot of cool things with Honey Honey. We were on a TV show called The Guest Book, where we wrote and we wrote the music for the show and performed in every episode, which was really a cool new badge to wear as a musician, that you could work in television, which, you know, now at this point in my life is something I'm mostly interested in, is working with you or getting my music in movies and TV so I can be home,
right,
you know, and still be an artist. But it's like, it's a fascinating journey and adventure. And at the same time, you know, like the music industry is entertainment in general, but is so unforgiving,
yeah.
You know, you really, is a lifestyle. It's,
well, we talked about this all the last episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah, it's a tough business. And it used to at least be, it's extremely tough, but there is some form of meritocracy there.
Yeah.
You know? It's and not, now I don't think there's
it's a, not much.
Now I think it's just tough.
No, well, there, you know, my buddy Rob Sanchez was telling me earlier today, Rick Beato is this very famous music producer. And he put out, he used three different AI programs to write the song, perform the song, and then like create this character. And it took 3 minutes to make a song.
Oh.
And it's, he says it's the worst song he's ever had, but it's as good as anything on Top 40.
Right. Well, that's, so you know, it's like, I mean, I don't think I shared this with you, but I read a couple of weeks ago, one of Spotify's AI artists has like 4 million followers.
Yep.
And there's an AI actress that CAA is now repping.
How is that even possible?
Well, I know. I'm just like, well, wait.
That's the dumbest shit. This is like Tamagotchis.
No,
I never understood.
But I'm asking, like,
plastic little.
What is the point of having
you know
a computer
about be
an actress if you still have to negotiate with them? Right? Like, doesn't that remove the whole impetus for doing it? But anyway. Okay, so it sounds like it was fair to say that in the end you gravitated towards music because for you it was a more personal form of artistic expression than acting, and it gave you agency over your own work. It let you communicate directly to an audience. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yes, and it just like it developed so quickly, and it felt like the call was very clear.
Yeah.
You know, like, and it would be foolish not to do something with this.
But it seems like your passion for music eclipsed your passion
absolutely
for acting.
Absolutely.
Encouragement or no.
100%.
Right?
And, you know, there's nothing like being in song and feeling that greater power above you, that thing, that God place. Like,
what is that? Talk about that.
You know, I don't want to say this like I'm taking it for granted, but it happens every time I sing. It happens when I sing alone or on a stage. It's like it's just like the door opened up and your spirit is right there.
Mm.
And it's always come very easily to me. It's not like I try to do it. It's just there. And, you know, I used to get really sad that like I fucked it up. You know, I used to be really sad because I never made it or you know, whatever. I never crested the hill or reached my goals. But, you know, like it's all beautiful. It's all the experience that helped me discover myself and helped me live in gratitude, because I don't need to be validated by money or fame to know that this is a special thing. Wherever it exists,
mm-hmm.
whether I'm singing at the corner bar for a few folks or singing for you, you know, it's its own thing. And, you know, I'll try to make a business of it as best as I can within the boundaries of of my priorities. Mm-hmm. But it was like, there was no question. Like once I really started playing music that like acting was not a necessary part of my life. Now I will say it was really fun to act in your movie last year.
Yeah.
And I got a little role, had a few lines, and I had the best time just working with you because it's
well, you
so
were
fun.
Great. And acting is acting is fun.
It's fun.
I really enjoy acting.
You're a great actor.
Thank you. You know, I've told people before because I've had friends who said, like, why didn't you ever act? And some of them are actors.
Right.
And I was like, because that looks like the worst job in the world. I said, being a movie star is a great job.
Right, right, right.
Being an actor is a terrible job.
Well, also, like,
and also, I have to be able to respect myself as a man.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, we've talked, I mean, this is off topic because we're, you know, talking about our beginnings, but like, the life of an actor or actress where you have to be romantic, quote unquote, romantically linked with another actor and you're touching each other and kissing and or having a sex scene, but then you have a real life with a, you know, husband or wife or kids, like the amount of emotional confusion and pain that would cause in our lives is immeasurable.
Oh,
would just never happen. We would never
like do that. I just wouldn't sign up for that. Yeah. I just know myself better than that.
That's rough.
Yeah, but I guess, you know, it works for some people. I've known actors that won't do those scenes, you know, and they're good enough actors that they can actually dictate those terms.
That's the life.
But yeah,
an action star.
It seems like a weird thing, you know, and at the best of times. It seems like a really weird thing. Yeah, well, it's funny. Do you know in ancient Rome, they classified actors at the same level
as
prostitutes.
Yep.
And they weren't allowed to vote either.
Oh, my God.
So I've always thought that was a little telling. But now that said, I have immense respect for actors. Some of my best friends are actors. And they're... are few pleasures I've found as a creator that are as fulfilling as watching a great actor say my words and bring my character to life and fully inhabit it and bring it into the dimensional world. And so for that, I'm always grateful for them, but it's not a life I could have.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you do have some very nice friends.
Yeah.
You know, but then there's some weirdos too.
Yeah. There are.
So I think I dodged a bullet, you know, even though I think I would have liked the paycheck of a working actor more than a working musician.
I even wonder about that. Yeah, I guess. But I guess if you're on a show or something, sure. But if you're not a legit star, it is so like feast or famine.
Yeah,
like,
it's brutal.
You know,
people.
Maybe you have a recurring part on a show that's on prime time and you're doing great. Well, then it ends and you might not have anything for 2 years, or you might suddenly be like, oh, now I'm the guest star on somebody else's show for one episode.
Yeah. And then if you don't get some kind of campaign or like, you know, tequila endorsement.
Yeah. But you have to be big for that. That's what I'm saying is if you're not a star,
right,
that is a rough life. I mean, people would be surprised at the amount of people they have seen on their TVs in multiple shows, crossing their eye lines. They would recognize them in life. They would be shocked at how little money a lot of those people have.
Yeah, no, it's brutal. So, yeah, well, you know, music didn't do me any financial favors either. So, well, I will say I guess if I were to count my blessings, which I prefer to do because, you know, nobody wants to hear you sit and complain.
No.
But when I was 32 was when I really started working as a musician. And I can say that felt like a real accomplishment. Like I didn't need a side job.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask what you meant by working.
I didn't need
musician.
To like supplement with
you
other
didn't
things
need to supplement
or need to call
income.
My mom and dad for money.
You could make a living playing music. Okay.
And then in 2018, I got scouted to play with the artist Hozier. And I was his like utility player. I played guitar and violin and sang background vocals. And literally toured the world with him. And I got to open for him as well, which was really cool. And I would say that was like that was a good pinnacle, you know, having to getting to be on those stages and play in front of 60,000 people. And, you know,
it was like an incredibly rigorous performance schedule, right? And the amount of music you were expected to learn. Mm-hmm.
But I loved that. Loved how, I mean, that was the strongest my voice was, like, by a landslide. Like, I could sing, I think I like went up an octave even. It was wild how well I could sing then. And just like performance wise, like I had to be a better guitar player than I was to keep up. And I kind of like have him to thank for a lot of my guitar playing now, because I don't know if I would have played guitar that much if I were just left to my own devices.
Almost certainly, you know, not.
It was like camp. It was like music camp. I mean, when we would rehearse, it'd be like 8 hours a day, if not more. And then I'd go home and practice more because I didn't want to suck or get fired. So that was wild, you know. And funny enough, like I left his band because I wanted to get back to my own music, and I didn't care if I was back in the van.
Right.
But right when I was leaving his band, I was asked to be in Beck's band. And but like also Beck would have paid me less money, and I was like, why am I leaving the band that pays me more money for another band that pays less, and I'm still not going to play my own music? And, you know, that was actually a really big revelation of like walking away from this coveted job. I guess, you know, that's
well, it was the same thing for me too, is I want to play my own stuff.
I wanted to play my own stuff. And a lot of people might've thought that was foolish that I walked away too, you know, because it was a great exposure, but also I was very unhappy. I was like so miserable, and I was home 50 days that year, and I really like, I just got tired of playing other people's music.
Sure.
It wasn't what I wanted to do. And then, you know, but it was great money. It was great. I took all that money and made a record with it. And, you know, and now we're here. Now we're like living our life in love with our kids and each other. And now when I get to play music, it's just thrilling. You know, it's mm-hmm. like, I have no expectations. I just want to make beautiful music, and I hope it's useful. I hope it either finds its way in someone else's project for film or television, or it makes people feel good, or they love it, or they're moved. Like, that's all I can say.
Well, you know, something that was really driven home to me the past couple of years was that you throw your rock out there, and you never know what the ripples it creates are going to go on to do. You don't know who's going to be inspired by what you did. You don't know whose life just got saved because of what you did.
Sure.
You don't know if it's going to turn
I've
up.
I've had that before. People tell me my song saved them from suicide. And like, what can you say to that? I mean, it's going to make me cry.
You know, I have those.
I know.
I get those notes from people. And they're always humbling and deeply touching, and bring me back to a place of reverence and respect that I need to be in to do good work. But that's what I'm saying. I didn't create that stuff intending for it to have those effects, but it's very gratifying to know that they did.
Absolutely.
And you know, you create something, you don't know if in 20 years some number one selling young female artist is going to be like, oh my God, Suzanne Santo. She was like this huge.
You might not have heard. You probably haven't heard of her.
she was huge. She was huge for me.
I love that. No, and that's where it all feels good, you know, and it is very important not to live your life thinking about what didn't happen, you know,
always.
It's just, you're going to lose so much when you operate from that.
Well, and the answer is always the same, no matter what kind of life you've had or what kind of fortunes you've had, what didn't happen? The answer is a whole lot. A whole lot didn't happen. And some of the things you wanted to happen didn't happen, but a bunch of things you don't want to happen also didn't happen.
Right.
And these are things to be grateful for. Yeah. And it's
sort of, I still have my legs.
Yeah, it's sort of that thing about when people say they deserve this or that, and I just don't think deserve comes anywhere into the equation. And if you start thinking along those lines, I think you should probably be grateful you didn't get what you deserve. Not you, but anonymous you, a human being. you know, we should be grateful we didn't get what we deserve, because who knows what we
deserve. I feel like that. Well,
under
look,
that kind of
look,
calculus.
I've thought about this. We've talked about this. Like, say I hit it big as some like massively famous musician, and then what if I didn't meet you? You know, what if I moved to Austin because I was so tired of Los Angeles and just wanted a better life for myself, you know, and I wanted to try something different, you know, like have a home life, you know, and who knows, man, I'm so grateful for all of it. I'm really like the failures, the whatever
I want to say this too, until death, there is no failure.
Mm.
That's it. There's no failure. There's only the struggle. And when you stop, then I suppose that could be a failure, but the struggle goes on till the life is over.
God, I don't know if we should say anything after that. That's perfect.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Great.
I love you.
I love you too.
That was great.
Okay, babe.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode 2 of Pod With You. Please throw us some pointers. Give us some topics you want us to cover. We can chat this out. Until then,
yeah.
Be well. Take care of yourself.
Bye.